Hello and welcome to your talking newspaper for St Albans, Harpenden and the surrounding area. I'm Bill and this is the Red Saturn programme for Saturday, March 16th, 2024. I do hope you're all well.
But I don't mind, I know I'm bound to find my own hilltop home.
The music this week is Rich Man's Hill, a song written and performed by a young folk singer called Maz O'Connor. She wrote the song for a collaborative CD entitled Sweet Liberties. Her notes on the album say, "This tells the story of a homeless man wandering around London and believing that if he only works hard enough, he will one day live in a Richmond mansion." I'll play it in full at the end of the programme. This week, as usual, we have the news stories, the radio selections, and the audio-described television listings, followed by an opportunity to listen again to Rupert Evershed's Nature Notes from March 2021. After this, we have a bit of a sporting theme, with an article from Hearts Life magazine about one of the greatest racing drivers of all time, Hertfordshire's very own Sir Lewis Hamilton. After this, St Albans resident Tom McNabb reads part one of a four-part account of his involvement with the production of the film Chariots of Fire some 40 years ago. Some of you may know that Tom was one of the UK's leading athletics coaches, as well as an acclaimed novelist. Parts 2 to 4 of this account will be included in later programmes. Then Liz reads the story of Rose Riley, the lost superstar of Scottish women's football. If all these sporting tales leave you itching to get up and do something yourselves, we have just the thing in 10 today, our series of short 10-minute exercise routines to help keep you moving at home. After this, you can enjoy our regular series of fascinating but short articles about events that took place during this week in the past. We start with the news, and our readers this week are Lucy, Ian, Anne and Hilary.
Hi there, this is Lucy, and really good to be reading for you again today. First article is all about the controversial rail freight terminal. A date has been set for the rail freight hearing. Campaigners' legal challenge against Hertfordshire County Council's £34 million sale of the former site of Radlett Airfield will be heard at the Royal Courts of Justice this summer. On June the 11th, a judge will be asked to grant permission for a judicial review to go ahead at a hearing. If permission is granted, the judicial review will follow immediately on the same day. If the review concludes that Hertfordshire County Council did not follow the correct legal process when selling the land to rail freight developers Segro, the sale will be overturned. Campaigners from Save St Albans Fight the Freight argue that when the county council agreed to buy the land for £1 in the mid-1980s, it was bought as permanent open space for the benefit of the local community. The council has repeatedly argued that the decision to sell followed all due process. In response to an inquiry about the impending hearing, a spokesperson for Hertfordshire County Council said, "We continue to be confident that the sale of the land in Radlett to Segro for use as a strategic freight rail interchange was undertaken in accordance with all due processes." Meanwhile, Councillor Nuala Webb, one of the leaders of the Save St Albans Fight the Freight group, said, "This will be a huge day for us and everyone who lives in the St Albans area. If the ruling goes our way, it will block the development of a totally unnecessary freight terminal on a totally unsuitable site." Save St Albans Fight the Freight is currently attempting to raise £25,000 to fund their legal challenge against the Greenbelt sale. They've already lodged £7,000 with the court to ensure the hearing on June the 11th goes ahead. Councillor Webb added, "We've had a great response so far and raised £14,000 in a couple of weeks. It shows the strength of feeling locally and a belief in our case, but we need more people to back us. It really is a case that affects the future of our community."
Hello, this is Hilary. 9-year-old raising money for children in Gaza. A girl from St Albans has embarked on an epic swimming challenge to raise money for children affected by conflict in Gaza and Israel. Raya, age 9, is raising money for Save the Children's Gaza Emergency Appeal by swimming 1,000 metres. Raya's proud mum, Annie, said that her daughter is keen to change the world and that ever since she's been very little, she's always wanted to help her community. It's reining her in, that's the issue. Annie said that Raya was prompted to take action after seeing videos of events in Gaza on Newsround and particularly the devastating impact on children there. Annie said, Raya feels so strongly about it. She was shocked by what she saw and talked about how unfair it was. She told me that she wanted to do something herself, that we have to try to help these people. Raya has already completed half of the challenge, having swum 500 metres. While her initial aim was £1,000 for 1,000 metres, she has already exceeded that total and is keen to add to it. You can donate by visiting her Just Giving page, Raya-Swimming-Challenge. Save the Children's Gaza Appeal is distributing essential supplies, delivering mental health support services, providing fuel and water infrastructure for hospitals, and setting up child-friendly spaces for people in Gaza. According to the World Health Organization, at least 10 children have died in a Gaza hospital in recent days due to a lack of food. Gaza's Hamas-run health ministry says that more than 30,500 people, including 12,300 children, have been killed in Gaza since Israel launched its campaign to destroy Hamas in October 2023. Israel was responding to a Hamas attack that killed about 1,200 people and saw 253 taken back to Gaza as hostages.
Hello, I'm Ian. Mystery Hearts Man wins £1 million in prize draw. A mystery man from Hertfordshire has been confirmed as a £1 million winner. The National Lottery has not offered much information about the anonymous millionaire after announcing the result on Monday. The man, known only as Mr. M from Hertfordshire, scooped the prize in the EuroMillions UK Millionaire Maker draw on January the 19th. Senior winners advisor at the National Lottery, Andy Carter, said, "Wow, this is really great news for Mr. M, who can now celebrate becoming a millionaire overnight after winning this incredible prize. Huge congratulations." National Lottery operators Allwyn explained that winners are given the opportunity to release their name, remain anonymous, or, like Mr. M, release some details through partial publicity. Allwyn took control of the National Lottery from Camelot on February the 1st, after the UK Gambling Commission officially awarded it the licence. It marked the first time the game has changed hands since it launched almost 30 years ago.
Hello, my name is Anne, and my first article is entitled Plans to Hold Market Throughout the Week, with the subtitle Council to Discuss Options with Traders. Traders will be in discussion with St Albans City and District Council over plans to hold small-scale markets throughout the week. Currently, charter markets take place on Wednesdays and Saturdays in the city centre, but an increased demand has seen proposals put forward for additional markets on the remaining 5 days of the week. At this time, the council allows up to 6 street traders to operate outside of charter market days by means of street trading consents. However, the proposed new markets would see up to 10 traders sell their wares each day. Charter market traders would not be charged any higher fee than on Wednesdays and Saturdays, but street traders who currently hold a street trading consent would pay fees in line with the proposed smaller market charges. The plans have now been put back until June to allow for conversations with the people set to be most affected. The Green Party's Councillor Simon Grover has criticised the proposed increase in fees for street traders. He said, "Greens on St Albans Council have pushed back against radical plans by the administration to massively increase fees for street traders on the market, increases that would have put traders out of business. Hopefully now we have the opportunity to think through this issue more carefully and come up with something that works as well as it can for all stakeholders and doesn't put local companies out of business. Councillor Chris White, the leader of St Albans City and District Council, said, "We have listened to people who will be impacted by these proposals and have acted by deciding to look at this initiative in granular detail. We want to make sure that our plans will get the support as far as possible of everyone involved, particularly our wonderful traders who contribute so much to the local economy, as well as the vibrancy of the city centre. I will be talking personally to the street traders, explaining our amended plans, taking on board feedback and deciding on the best way forward with senior council officers."
Our next article is about Labour, who have selected their general election candidate for the constituency. Labour have selected their candidate for the St Albans constituency at the upcoming general election. Sophia Adams-Barty was selected by party members on Wednesday, March the 6th, to contest the seat in the election, which must be held no later than January 2025. She's expected to be up against Daisy Cooper, the Liberal Democrat MP for the constituency, and James Spencer, who was selected as the Conservative candidate last year. Sophia, a mother of two, currently works as Head of Purpose and Impact at Simmons & Simmons, an international law firm. Her previous jobs in the private and public sectors include working as a regulator in healthcare, immigration and financial services. Sophia has lived in Bishop Stortford since 1999 and stood unsuccessfully to be selected as Labour's parliamentary candidate for Hertford and Stortford earlier this year. Speaking after her selection, Sophia said, "I'm absolutely delighted to have been selected as Labour's parliamentary candidate for St Albans. It's a real honour. I've focused my entire career on building a fairer society for all and fighting for the rights of ordinary people. As a mum with a career and a commuter, I know how we need to improve services for working people. People in St Albans need a champion who will fight for change in Parliament. As our Labour candidate and MP, I promise to put the needs of our community first."
Plans for maths tutors to occupy empty unit. Plans have been submitted for a maths tuition provider to occupy an empty unit in St Albans city centre. Advertisement consent and change of use permission is being sought by Mathnasium for the vacant spot at 15 Hollywell Hill. If accepted, the plans would see the site's usage change from Class E commercial to an educational centre. One externally illuminated fascia sign, one non-illuminated fascia sign, and one non-illuminated projecting sign are also included in the application. A planning statement reads, "Mathnasium operate on a membership basis, rather like a gymnasium, and on average each student attends 2 to 3 times per week for 60 to 90 minutes per visit. With careful scheduling, it is generally expected to have up to 100 students per day passing through the doors once the centre is at full capacity. There are in excess of approximately 15 Mathnasium centres operating in the UK and more in the pipeline.
AI pothole robot tested on Harts Road. The world's first AI-powered pothole robot has completed its maiden road test in Hertfordshire. A county council video showcasing the Autonomous Road Repair System, ARRES, revealed it passing with flying colours after a test run near Potter's Bar last Wednesday. It was the first time the prototype vehicle had been used outside of a lab environment since development started in 2020. Officially named ARRES Prevent, the robot uses artificial intelligence, AI, to identify defects in the road and fill the cracks to keep out water, which should stop potholes from forming. It was developed by tech company Robotized and academics from the University of Liverpool in collaboration with Council Highways Engineers. Councillor Rena Ranger, Deputy Executive Member for Highways, said, "The test is another step in the right direction towards solving the pothole problem this country faces." She added the council was trialling new techniques as it has fixed over 40,000 potholes this year. "We're committed to maintaining our road network so that it remains one of the best in the country. We're excited for the time we can welcome Prevent officially to our team," she added. HCC claims it will revolutionise how the world combats the issue, saving time and money whilst reducing disruption to drivers.
This article is entitled "Barrett Homes Donates £1,500 to Counselling Charity." Barrett Homes has made a generous £1,500 donation to the Counselling Foundation. The St Albans charity provides counselling services to around 400 clients weekly, making it an integral contributor to mental health in the region. Also provides professional training courses, helping people become a qualified counsellor. The donation will be directed to individuals unable to afford counselling sessions. It comes from the Barrett Foundation, the householder's charity partnership. Tracy McPhillips from the Counselling Foundation said, "Barrett North Thames donation will go towards making sure that individuals who might not be able to access counselling will be able to seek help, and ultimately this will change lives for them and those around them for the better." Mark Wolfe, Director of Sales and Marketing at Barrett North Thames, affirmed their hope for the donation to raise awareness and continued support for mental health needs.
Our next article is about the popular French restaurant Côte Brasserie, which is set to reopen next week following a major redesign. A VIP champagne party will take place next Thursday night, March the 21st, before the High Street Eatery officially reopens the following day. The restaurant has been closed since mid-January, with a refurbishment taking place to provide more comfort in a modern design. As with many of the chain's branches, including Welwyn Garden City, the restaurant has been rebranded to simply Côte. A stunning new look has also been promised. Extra space has been introduced around tables, allowing more room to mingle. Warm lights, plants, mirrors, and a brand new bar have also been installed. The branch will allow seating for 140 guests and follows recent refurbishments in Bristol and Kingston, with more to follow in 2024. Newly appointed general manager Yona Deku said, "We've kept the heart of Côte and given it a makeover to make the French art of gathering together around the table an everyday reality. The restaurant is fresh and modern, with more room, more comfort and more reasons to linger. The new bar is an exciting one for us. Our new cocktail range not only means more choice, but amazing French classics and more occasions for guests to come and see us. We can't wait to welcome the community back and see them laughing, chatting and connecting whilst raising a glass. Sharing those moments is so much more than just eating and drinking." A new menu has also been designed by Gordon Ramsay's former executive chef, Steve Allen. Steve has worked at Restaurant Gordon Ramsay, Petrus, and opened Gordon Ramsay at Claridge's, which won a Michelin star within its first year. The chef added, "I've been cooking French cuisine since the age of 13. Our menu is a reflection of everything I love about French food. Our main focus is and always will be about the taste of our food at Côte. Simple, yet complex and delicious." And there's a photo accompanying this article, and I have to say that the stunning new look really does live up to its billing.
Amputee fundraising for Running Blade. A woman from Harpenden who had her leg amputated is determined to achieve great things after organising a fun run to raise money for a running blade. Francesca Berry was diagnosed with desmoid fibromatosis in her left foot in 2020, a tumour that affects only 5 to 6 people in a million. The 28-year-old began chemotherapy without much success, and due to the pain, she opted for surgery to have the tumour removed, but it grew back more aggressively, wrapping around her bones and tendons. Francesca decided to undergo a below-knee amputation on November the 16th, 2023, returning home just 3 days later and moving around on crutches after just 24 hours. Around 40 people gathered at Rothamsted Park in Harpenden, running either 5 kilometres or 10 kilometres in a bid to raise money for a specially adapted wheelchair and a running blade. A keen sportswoman before her reputation, Francesca is keen to achieve great things and dreams of running again. I'm an extremely determined individual and I want to live the best life that I can as an amputee, she said. I want to achieve great things, which is why these funds will help so much. I dream of being able to run again and walk properly with no pain. Prior to my amputation, I was a very keen tennis player, and having found a real passion for the sport, I've now taken up wheelchair tennis. I really wasn't keen at first, but my mum encouraged me to give it a go, and now I absolutely love it. I'm hoping to start competing in March and have big goals for the future, and these funds will help massively towards a competitive wheelchair. Running blades are not available on the NHS and cost £10,000, with Francesca already halfway to her £20,000 fundraising target. As well as the fun run, a fundraising quiz night has been planned, while Francesca and her mum, Carolyn, are set to take part in Henley Club to Pub Open Water Swim in the River Thames on July the 27th. I just want to say a huge thank you to everyone who has donated, shared my page or posted words of encouragement. I've been blown away by the support and it genuinely means the world to me, Francesca added. To donate to Francesca, visit gofundme.com/f/findingmyfeetagain.
Nominate charity to feature on City's Monopoly Board. As a way of thanking the public for their reaction to St Albans receiving its own Monopoly Board, the Games organisers have announced that one of the city's charities will feature. The chosen organisation will be seen as a star on one of Monopoly St Albans Edition's community chess spaces, and residents have been invited to nominate their preferred choice. Charities are also able to nominate themselves for the honour until 11:59pm on March the 25th. Nominations can be made via either the official St Albans Monopoly Facebook page or by emailing stalbans@winningmoves.co.uk. Winning Moves announced the St Albans edition of the game late last month, with the public invited to nominate local landmarks and businesses to feature. Ella Gibbs, Customs Games Executive at Winning Moves UK, said, "We would like to formally thank each and every person who has sent in nominations, and, as our way of a thank you, a St Albans charity will now get to star in the game. We feel that the charity getting to feature on one of the board's community chess spaces is a great fit, bearing in mind the community aspect of these unique Monopoly features. The Monopoly St Albans edition will hit the shops this October in time for Christmas 2024.
Drink driver disqualified after crash is the heading for this article. A 24-year-old man has been disqualified from driving for a year after pleading guilty to drink driving during a crash in Markgate. Samir Ghafoor of Larkway Close in North London appeared at St Albans Magistrates Court on Friday, where he was also ordered to pay costs and a victim surcharge, totalling £120. The crash had taken place at around 5:30pm on Friday, September the 15th, when a black Mercedes and a black Audi collided on the A5183 southbound. Ghafoor, who was driving the Mercedes, was arrested at the scene and taken to custody. He will have the opportunity to reduce his driving ban by 3 months if he completes an approved rehabilitation course.
Rennie Grove Peace Hospice Care has taken delivery of a new van to support its retail operation thanks to a donation by the West Harts Charity Trust. The Citroen Relay van is used by the charity's retail and trading division to distribute donations between its 34 local high street shops and the charity's retail and trading hub in Berkhamsted. Since the merger between Rennie Grove and Peace Hospice Care, which formed Rennie Grove Peace, the charity has continued to expand its retail operation with two new shops due to open in southwest Hertfordshire this month. In order to keep stock moving between its charity shops and retail hub, Rennie Grove Peace needed an additional van and approached the West Harts Charity Trust to request a donation towards the purchase of a new one, after receiving generous support from the Trust in the past. The West Harts Charity Trust kindly made a significant donation that enabled the hospice charity to purchase a new van and keep its retail operation moving. The new van was handed over by Richard Minashi and Michael Humphreys to Rennie Grove Peace at its Grove House site in St Albans. Richard Minashi from West Harts Charity Trust said, "We are really delighted to donate towards the cost of a new van for Rennie Grove Peace Hospice Care. It's a practical way that we can help a local hospice charity that provides such vital care within our community." Deborah Gould, Director of Retail and Trading at Rennie Grove Peace Hospice Care, added, "I'd like to say a huge thank you to the West Harts Charity Trust for its support in helping us purchase a new van for our retail operation. With charity shops throughout Hertfordshire and Buckinghamshire, our van fleet really is crucial in keeping our charity shops trading. This donation will enable us to raise vital funds that are used by Rennie Grove Peace Hospice Care to support local people who are living with a life-limiting illness. Rennie Grove Peace Hospice Care is urgently seeking quality donations in all its local charity stores. And to find your nearest shop and to donate today, please visit the website renniegrovepeace.org/r-shops.
And now some news about World Book Day. Children across St Albans and Harpenden dressed up in their best costumes for World Book Day. Among the creative costumes on display last Thursday were several Willy Wonkas, Matilda, Sherlock Holmes and the Worst Witch, and one very scary Lord Voldemort. Some of the more unusual costumes included 10-year-old Valen, who dressed up as Sir David Attenborough, and 7-year-old Ascala Wyman-Baptiste, who dressed up as the Sun. 6-year-old Lenny Mansell dressed up as the Mad Hatter from Alice in Wonderland, and Mum Stephanie said Lenny took the role of the Mad Hatter very seriously. All poses were chosen by him, recreating images he had been imagining, portraying the character to the best of his ability. I think he did a fantastic job. And there are some wonderful colour photographs illustrating all of these costumes. First up is 4-year-old Grace Farr, dressed up as the Very Hungry Caterpillar. She's actually a butterfly with her arms out, displaying her beautiful wings. Next is Chloe Atkinson, who's 8. She came as the Worst Witch in a fantastic pointy black hat. Then Isabella Gauthier, who is 4. She's come as Zog from the picture book Zog. George Atkinson, who's 4, came as Danny from The Dinosaur That Pooped a Planet. And he's there in his astronaut costume. Then we've got 5-year-old Tarion as Harry Potter with his wand. 8-year-old Lily as Coraline in a fantastic yellow mac, purple wig and 2 button eyes. And there's Adie, who's 8, and Finny, 2, as Sherlock Holmes and the Very Hungry Caterpillar. Sherlock Holmes has a deerstalker hat, a magnifying glass and a pipe, and the Hungry Caterpillar has a basket full of fruit.
History Society welcomes Mayor to Museum. Mayor of St Albans, Councillor Anthony Rowlands, recently visited the new Harpenden Museum at the Eric Morecambe Centre. He was welcomed by Councillor Fiona Gaskell, Mayor of Harpenden and Honorary President of Harpenden and District Local History Society, Kate Barton, Manager of the Auburn Arena and the Eric Morecambe Centre, and History Society Chairman Roger Butterworth. Curator David Keane gave Councillor Rowlands a guided tour of the museum, and archivist Rosemary Ross gave him a tour of the archive. At the end of the visit, Councillor Rowlands said, "Promoting an interest in our local history and encouraging intergenerational initiatives are the 2 themes of our mayoral year. It was exciting to visit the new headquarters of Harpenden and District Local History Society. The thoughtfully arranged displays provide a vivid insight into Harpenden's fascinating history and will appeal to young and old and all those in between. Roger Butterworth thanked the mayor for his visit and presented him with a copy of the Society's history. On Saturday, April the 20th, the Society is holding a Local History Day to celebrate its 50th anniversary and the official opening of the new museum. And the article is accompanied by a photograph showing Councillor Anthony Rowlands with Roger Butterworth and Councillor Fiona Gaskell outside the Harpenden Museum.
This next article is entitled Mayor's Pride Awards Winners. Event celebrates people who make a priceless contribution to our community. The winners of the St Albans Mayor's Pride Awards 2024 have been revealed, with St Albans Community Pantry achieving double success. The charity, which rehomes surplus food to those in distress, bagged 2 of the 10 accolades presented to honour the contribution of community heroes in the district. Each year, the Mayor's Pride Awards highlight individuals and organisations who have made significant contributions to the community at a special ceremony. Approximately 100 people were part of the celebration at St Albans City and District Council's Civic Centre on Tuesday, March the 5th, and more than 100 more viewed a live webcast of the event. Participants savoured treats from the pudding stop and songs from folk duo Elizabeth and Jameson before the official ceremony was compared by Johnny Seabrook of Mix 92.6. Mayor Anthony Rowlands had made All Ages Together the theme of his service year and personally chose the receivers of 2 awards. Councillor Rowlands said, "These awards celebrate people, young and old alike, who make a priceless contribution to our community. I thank them as mayor on behalf of the whole community for making these extraordinary efforts to help others, and hope that these awards show how grateful we are for the work that they do." The Mayor's Intergenerational Award joint winners were Skyeswood Primary and Nursery School and the Orchard Nursing Home for their contributions to cross-generational connections.
And now an article from St Albans MP Daisy Cooper on the impact of this year's budget and its combination of disastrous decisions and small, sensible ideas. The budget is one of the biggest events in the political calendar, and while the Chancellor's speech happens on one day, the speculation and dissection means the event can dominate the headlines for more than a week. Normally, in the preceding days, different tax cuts and spending ideas under consideration are trailed in the newspapers to test how popular they might be before the Chancellor decides to commit to them. On the day itself, there's the photograph outside number 11 Downing Street with the traditional red box. And then the Chancellor normally enjoys making some surprise announcements to raucous cheers from his backbenchers. The government is then pretty much guaranteed good headlines for around 3 days, whilst opposition MPs and journalists are left hurriedly raking through the small print. This year, however, was far more sedate. There were no rabbits out of the hat. Even the main announcement, a pre-election 2p cut in national insurance, barely raised a cheer out of Conservative backbenchers. The Chancellor's claim to be cutting taxes was roundly debunked within minutes. The truth is that millions of people will be worse off next year, as they're dragged into paying higher levels of income tax. Unbelievably, the government failed to invest any new money into our NHS, a disastrous decision given the huge numbers of people struggling to see a GP or a dentist, the 7.7 million people waiting for an NHS operation, the huge delays in cancer treatment, and the growing backlog of hospital building repairs. As always, there were some small and sensible announcements that even opposition MPs could welcome. The government scrapped the £90 charge for debt relief order, as called for by Citizens Advice, and extended the recovery loan scheme for small businesses. Both measures are sensible, but both are also a sombre reminder of the fragility of finances for so many families and small businesses alike. Commentators quickly concluded that the budget would make little difference to economic growth or to people's lives. Many said this was the Conservatives' last chance to turn the country's economic fortunes around. In the event, the budget came and went, not with a bang, but with a whimper.
Sweeney Todd Musical tells gritty tale of revenge. Harpenden Musical Theatre Company is inviting audiences to step into the shadowy streets of Victorian London with Sweeney Todd. The production of Stephen Sondheim's hit musical will take place at the Eric Morecambe Centre from March the 20th to the 23rd. Tickets are available by calling the box office or going to their website. The musical follows the story of Benjamin Barker, who was wrongfully sent to prison and re-emerges as the vengeful Sweeney Todd. With the help of accomplice Mrs. Lovett, Todd embarks on a murderous quest to settle scores and restore justice, all served with a side of savoury pies. A spokesperson for Harpenden Musical Theatre Company said, "Stephen Sondheim's haunting and beautiful score adds depth and emotion to every scene. From the sinister Epiphany to the darkly comic A Little Priest, the music will weave its way into your soul and leave an indelible mark. Sweeney Todd is not just a show, it's an experience that takes you on a journey into the depths of the human psyche, and a darkly captivating tale of love, revenge, and the price of obsession. This will be a night you won't forget in a hurry."
Celebrating aged lager beer. St Albans beer columnist Roger Protz encourages enthusiasts to taste the difference with aged lager beer and recommends some to try. The meaning of lager may not be as important as the meaning of life, but to beer lovers, understanding the process that produces the world's favourite alcoholic drink is critical to its appreciation. Lager is a German word meaning storage. Historically, lager beer was stored and aged for several months. The early lager brewers stored their beer in icy caves in the Alps in Bavaria, southern Germany. But with industrialisation in the 19th century, breweries were built with deep cellars cooled by refrigeration. There the beer rested, aged and matured for lengthy periods. The first golden lager was brewed in the middle of the 19th century in the Bohemian town of Pilsen, which gave its name to Pilsner beer. Today the brewery ages its beer for 44 days. In the south of the Czech Republic, the Budweiser Budvar brewery takes even longer, aging its beer in ice-cold cellars for a remarkable 90 days. In sharp contrast, most of the beer produced by giant global brewers can't really be called lager. In 2021, Greg Wallace's Inside the Factory programme followed the brewing process at the Molson Coors plant in Burton-on-Trent, where Carling is made. The beer was ready to drink in just 12 days, which has become the norm for most of the major brands such as American Budweiser, Carlsberg, Foster's and Stella Artois. At a meeting at Carlsberg in Copenhagen, a top brewer told me bluntly, "We've taken the lagering out of lager," and said his beer could be made as quickly as ale. But a number of smaller British breweries are now making properly aged lager beer. Chief among them is the Utopian Brewery near Crediton in Devon, which is celebrating its fifth anniversary with a special beer called Augsburger Export. Utopian's signature is to use only British ingredients, and Export is brewed with lager malt from Warminster Maltings in Wiltshire and just one hop, the classic English Fuggle.
Finding soul food at the Quadrant. This article in the Faith Focus column is from the Reverend Kate Pearson, who's vicar of St Mary's Church, on how her community's parade of shops provides food for the soul. I love the Quadrant in Marshalswick. It's a bustling, friendly shopping area with library, small businesses focused on health and well-being, a community centre, cafes and restaurants. The Quadrant is opposite our little church, and is a brilliant feature of our community life and a place where there is lots of good food. With St Mary's and the Baptist Church also in its midst, I think we can go so far as saying that the Quadrant, in many ways, is a place of food for the soul. In the Church of England's calendar, we recently remembered the 16th century poet and priest George Herbert. at St Mary's Church, we meet in the mornings on weekdays to pray for our community and the world. At morning prayer that day, we together recalled a favourite Herbert poem, Love Bade Me Welcome. I give thanks for the quadrant when I remember George Herbert's encouragement to vicars to visit every person in one's parish at least once a year. With 8,500 people in this parish, many of whom might be a little confused as to why their local minister was ringing their doorbell, vicars have had to find new ways of getting to know their communities. As I've settled into the area, I've learnt to add 10 minutes to the time it takes me to walk across the quadrant to Marshalswick Library, to factor in the quick chats and warm hellos on the way. It really is a very special place. As politics becomes more divisive, as the gaps between individuals grow larger, and the temptation to hide amongst those who are most like us increases, these spaces of mingling and mixing become even more important. I'm certain that George Herbert would approve of the quadrant's provision of soul food, food for the body, mind and spirit. As the poem I began with goes on, he reminds us of the invitation to each of us from our God of love. My dear, then I will serve. You must sit down, says love, and taste my meat. So I did sit and eat.
And the final article today is about three young winners of a skateboard design competition who have seen their work transformed into actual skateboards in a prize-giving ceremony. The winners were presented with their prizes by Harpenden's Deputy Mayor, Councillor Pip Liver, and the co-chair of the Play Park Action Rothamsted Committee, or PARC, Rod Cooley. Genevieve from Harpenden Academy won in the 7 and under category. Florrie from Catherine Warrington School won in the 8 to 11 year olds. And Galax from Roundwood Park School won in the 12 to 16 year old category. PARC organised the competition to bolster their fundraising efforts aiming to redevelop the Rothamsted Park skate park. The charity, along with Harpenden Town Council, wants to build a revamped, inclusive and modern facility with innovative features to cater to people of all abilities and ages, including skateboarders, BMX bikers, scooters and those using adapted wheelchairs. Ms. Liver said, "Congratulations to all of the winners of this exciting competition and well done to everyone who took part, as the standard of creativity is incredible. Together with PARC, I would like to encourage Rothamsted PARC users, residents and local businesses to get in touch if they are able to support the fundraising appeal. Even small donations are so important. The budget for the skate park is £250,000, with the Town Council pledging £100,000 and the rest procured through community fundraising. While progress is being made, PARC is still appealing to Harpenden residents and businesses for their support. Andrew Hinkston, PARC trustee, said, "We would like to thank the Thompson's Gallery owner, Megan Thompson, for funding the manufacture of the winning skateboards and for hosting the prize-giving event. Thompson's Gallery is a great example of a Harpenden business supporting a local charity, and we hope that other Harpenden businesses will also sponsor PARC. The winning designs feature imaginative concepts, fabulous use of colour and individual style." And there are some great photos with this article. The first one, a picture of the winners with Megan, Thompson's Gallery owner, Rod Cooley, the park co-chair, and Harpenden Deputy Mayor, Councillor Pip Liver. And then there's a photo of Genevieve, winner of the 7 years and under category. Very, very colourful design, reds, yellows, greens, purples, blues, a big heart on there and some ghoulish faces, which really make her design stand out. Absolutely brilliant. And then there's Florrie, winner of the 8 to 11 year olds group, and a great big flame flashes right across the length of her skateboard in reds and purples. And then Galax, winner of the 12 to 16 year olds group, a really beautiful and very very intricate looking design in a manga comic style. All incredibly talented young people.
TNF Soundings. Features from across the UK.
Now for a look at some of this coming week's radio highlights, starting with Saturday, March 16th. In the first of three programmes from 2014, Four Extra Goes Gardening is presented by Penelope Keith from the home of garden designer Gertrude Jekyll. Radio Four Extra, 3 o'clock, Saturday afternoon. Family Business is a verbatim drama created with interviews recorded at John Lewis stores over 10 years, exploring how the aspirations of the British shopper have changed. Radio 4 for this at 3. Love's Old Sweet Song is a radio drama from 1985. Isabel and Olive are identical twins in their 80s. Life is serene, but when Frank comes on the scene, it's not too late for love to disrupt their friendship. Radio 4 Extra, 5 o'clock on Saturday. While the opera from the New York Metropolitan is Puccini's Turandot, a Radio 3, 6:30 Saturday evening. Sunday, March 17th, and Desert Island Discs Castaway is Jenny Seeley, Artistic Director of the Grey Theatre Company, a Radio 4, 11:15 in the morning. The Latvian Locum is a comedy drama by Ben Cottam. Dr. Day Zake is hired to work at a beleaguered medical centre in a deprived area of Blackpool, with new employers mistakenly believing she speaks Polish. Radio 4 Extra at 12:50 at lunchtime, or 10 to 7 in the evening. In Heart of Darkness, Anita Sullivan reshapes Joseph Conrad's story for a world of deforestation and climate change. Environmental scientist Maya is sent into the heart of the Congo rainforest after contact is lost with the research team. But what was the nature of their research and what's become of their charismatic team leader? Radio 4 for this drama, 3 o'clock Sunday afternoon. The Al Hamlet Summit is reimagining of Shakespeare's Hamlet, transported to a modern Arab state. Radio 3, Sunday evening, 7:30. On to programmes then that are broadcast at the same time, every day, same radio station, Monday to Friday. So if you listen on Monday, you can listen each day for the rest of the week till Friday. Book of the week is How to Win an Information War, Sefton Delmer, the genius propagandist who outwitted Hitler. Biography of the British journalist of Australian heritage who acted as a propagandist for the British government during the Second World War. It's on Radio 4, all week, Monday to Friday, 9:45 a.m. The dramatisation from 2011 of A Tale of Two Cities, Charles Dickens' story of love and loss in London and Paris before and during the French Revolution. Robert Lindsay, Alison Steadman and Andrew Scott are amongst the cast. Radio 4 Extra, 10 a.m. or 3 p.m. every day, Monday to Friday. Composer of the Week should be retitled Two Composers of the Week. Andrea Gabrielli, 1533 to 1585, and his nephew, Giovanni, 1557 to 1612. Radio 3, 12 noon every day, Monday to Friday. Sunshine and Laughter is a biography of Morecambe and Wise, read by Penelope Keith. Radio 4 Extra at noon every day, or 5 p.m. Book of Bedtime is Black Butterflies by Priscilla Morris. Early in 1992, as signs of spring and melting snow appear in Sarajevo, the atmosphere becomes increasingly tense. Zora and her husband Franjo have to make some tough decisions. Radio 4, 10:45 p.m. all week, Monday to Friday. So on to the individual programmes then to listen to through the rest of the week. Monday, March 18th. And start the week, the subject is intrigue and disinformation from the Russian Revolution to Ukraine invasion, examining the role of disinformation in Russian history. Radio 4, start the week, 9 a.m. Agatha Christie's 1937 novel, Dumb Witness, is dramatised in two parts, on Monday and Tuesday, 11 in the morning or 4 in the afternoon. Back to Monday, and an edition of the panel game Many a Slip from 1978 is on Radio 4 Extra at 2 in the afternoon or 7 p.m. while the second heat of Round Britain Quiz features teams from Northern Ireland and Scotland on Radio 4 at 3 p.m. Analysis this week asks how real is existential threat from AI, and reports on measures to protect against artificial intelligence by governments and tech companies. The programme considers how much more attention and money is applied to worst-case scenarios than to regulation regarding the very real current issues surrounding AI and the threat it poses to jobs. Radio 4, Monday night, 8:30. Tuesday, March 19th. In the Life Scientific, Jim Al-Khalili talks to Charles Godfrey, a population biologist with an interest in sustainable food production. Might there be enough food to go around in future, after all? Radio 4, Tuesday morning, 9 o'clock. In the last of the series, Young Again, author Philip Pullman is invited to consider what advice he'd give to his younger self. With Kirsty Young, Radio 4, 11 a.m. Panel show The Kitchen Cabinet comes on Tuesday from Bury St Edmunds, with a panel of culinary experts answering questions from the audience. Radio 4, 3 o'clock. In File on 4, the housing crisis continues. Families have fallen on hard times, are being offered a roof over their heads in stopgap homes, hotels, hostels, even shipping containers. Often it can be months or years before they stand any chance of getting a more permanent place to call home. The programme talks to children, their parents, about what it's like to be part of the growing legion of hidden homeless. Radio 4, Tuesday night, 8 o'clock. In Touch is presented, as usual, by Peter White. News and features for the blind and partially sighted, Radio 4, 8:40 p.m. While Witness History reports on the failed kidnapping of Princess Anne in 1974 on the Mall, Radio 4 Extra, 8:50 p.m. Wednesday, March 20th, a year of elections. In the last of the short series of The Briefing Room, aiming to provide clarity and understanding around this year of elections. Radio 4, 9 a.m. Dot is a comedy set in the personnel department of the wartime cabinet rooms. The second series starts on Radio 4 Extra at 12:30 lunchtime or 5:30 in the afternoon. Also on Wednesday, Choral Evensong comes from the Chapel of Winchester College, Radio 3 at 4. While in 2024, Scotland marks two big anniversaries. David I ascended the throne 9 centuries ago, and James I of Scotland began his reign 600 years ago. The programme, Free Thinking, hears about distinctly Scottish ideas of kingship and the founding myths of the Scottish kings, from the Stone of Destiny to James I and the Dream Vision tradition. Radio 3 for this, 10 o'clock in the evening. Thursday, March 21st, from our own correspondent, is presented by Kate Adie on Radio 4, just after 11 o'clock. The game show The Unbelievable Truth, in which panellists compete to see how many nuggets of truth they're able to hide amongst their lies, continues on Radio 4 Extra at 2 in the afternoon or 7 p.m. Ramblings? Claire Balding joins Hannah Engelkamp and her donkey, Chico, for a ramble in Powys. On the way, Hannah tells Claire about the extraordinary adventures she shared with Chico when they walked 1,000 miles around the perimeter of Wales. Radio 4 for Ramblings, 3 o'clock Thursday afternoon. And all over the planet, animals are fitted with sophisticated tracking devices by teams of dedicated scientists, which tell us much about what they're up to. But they record so much more. Modern trackers can also log local climate conditions, wind speed, temperature, even measures of the animal's own health. Tracking the Planet explores some of the stories that can be told about the animals that call this world home, and the much larger overarching story too, how the changing conditions are transforming their lives. Radio 4, Tracking the Planet, 4 o'clock, Thursday afternoon. So to Friday, March 22nd, the war the world forgot investigates Sudan's latest civil war, which began last April. The country's on the verge of a humanitarian crisis. Why isn't it being covered in the news? Radio 4, 11 a.m. Room 101 with Paul Merton continues on Friday morning at 11:30 on Radio 4. To go with the serialisation this week of Dickens' novel The Tale of Two Cities, examines the creative process behind the novel, A Tale of a Tale of Two Cities. Radio 4 Extra, 8 p.m. The political forum Any Questions comes from Hythe in Kent on Radio 4 at 8 on Friday night. Well, the Academy Award goes to is a reassessment from 2015 of William Wyler's 1942 patriotic drama, Miss Minerva, Radio 4 Extra, 9 p.m. That's it. Thank you to Wendy for the highlights this week. May I wish you a peaceful, safe and enjoyable one of radio listening.
TNF Soundings. Features from across the UK.
Hello, this is Helen with Val's selection of audio-described TV programmes, starting Saturday the 16th of March to Friday the 22nd of March 2024. We start with Saturday the 16th of March. Mary makes a brioche and apple frangipan tart in today's episode of Mary Berry's Simple Comforts on BBC One at 11:30 a.m. The Six Nations rugby comes to a close today with a triple bill, starting with Wales versus Italy, the kick-off at 2:15 on BBC One. Over on ITV One, Ireland versus Scotland kicks off at 4:45, and France versus England kicks off at 8 p.m, both on ITV One. Although not audio described, the commentary should give you an idea of the action. Now for a documentary featuring archive footage and insider interviews which charts the history of the relationship between Wales and the royal family. A Royal Guide to Wales is on Channel 4 at 7 p.m. In our weekly visit to the Saturday Night Hospital drama, Charlie fights for his life and recalls the start of his career, while Stevie struggles to regain her confidence in time to save him. Casualty is on BBC One at 9:25 p.m. A new six-part thriller starts tonight. When an Irish couple go missing from a New Zealand town, Irish detective Theo Richer heads out to liaise and explore a possible gang connection, teaming up with Maori cop Diana Hua. The Gone is on BBC Four at 9 p.m, with a second episode following at 9:50. Now on to Sunday the 17th of March. Sunday with Laura Koonsberg, featuring interviews with politicians and key public figures, is on BBC One at 9 a.m. The chef goes behind the scenes of Highgrove House in Gloucestershire in Raymond Blanc's Royal Kitchen Gardens on BBC One at 11:30 a.m. We find out what is involved in the launch of the White Chocolate Digestive. Inside McVitie's is on Channel 4 at 6:40 p.m. Four new celebrities test their baking skills under the eye of Paul Hollywood and Prue Leith in a new series of the Great Celebrity Bake Off for Stand Up to Cancer on Channel 4 at 7:40. Featuring three pieces with a magical and mythical air, including Grieg's Piano Concerto, performed by the National Orchestra of Wales, Inside Classical is on BBC 4 at 8 p.m. When a British tourist dies, at first it appears to have been a mysterious accident, but the case soon takes a turn after a series of surprising connections. Death in Paradise is on BBC One at 9 p.m. When the body of 32-year-old Marlene Doyle is discovered in her boyfriend's flat, West Midlands police piece together an evidential jigsaw. Forensics, The Real CSI, is on BBC Two at 9 p.m. Here are the programmes which are on at the same time throughout the week. Animal Park is at 10:45. Homes Under the Hammer is at 11:30. Bargain Hunt is at 12:15. Doctors is at 1:45, but not on Friday. And Escape to the Country is at 3 p.m. All these programmes are on BBC One. There is a new series of Great British Railway Journeys this week at 6:30, Monday to Friday, on BBC Two. Fletcher's Family Farm is on ITV One at 2 p.m, Wednesday to Friday. There are two episodes of Heartbeat on ITV3 at 5:55 and 6:55, Monday to Friday. It's Vera Week on ITV3 with an episode of the crime drama at 8 p.m, Sunday to Friday. Let's see what's on offer for Monday the 18th of March. It's a penultimate semi-final in Mastermind tonight at 7:30, followed by the quarter-finals in University Challenge at 8:30, both on BBC Two. A couple decide to swap city life for the Chiltern Hills and renovate an old barber's shop and its attached 17th century building. Find out how they get on in George Clark's Remarkable Renovations on Channel 4 at 8 tonight. Strictly Come Dancing stars Anton Dubek and Giovanni Panici travel to Spain on an epic adventure across Anton's motherland in the new travel series Anton and Giovanni's Adventures in Spain on BBC One at 9 p.m. Ade Adapitan spends a week in the South African town of Orania, whose population is exclusively white. As he gets to know the residents, Ade tries to understand why they are so eager to create a society where multiculturalism seems to have no place. The documentary Whites Only, Ade's Extremist Adventure, is on Channel 4 at 10 p.m. Moving on to Tuesday the 19th of March. Dave Myers and Cy King finished their 650-mile foodie tour in Dorset and Devon. The Hairy Bikers Go West is on BBC Two at 7 p.m. The remaining contestants create activity centres for school children visiting Chester Zoo, themed around the wildlife of Brazil, India and Madagascar, in tonight's episode of Interior Design Masters with Alan Carr on BBC One at 8 p.m. In Dungeness, the lifeboat crew are called out to a small boat in the middle of shipping lanes, but on the way back to the station, they discover the casualty is the subject of a major manhunt. Saving Lives at Sea is on BBC Two at 8 p.m. Part of Channel 4's True Crime season, this three-part documentary series explores the life of Charles Sobhraj, who was released from a Nepalese prison in 2022. Former Metropolitan Police Detective Jackie Moulton starts to re-examine five killings in the 1970s that were linked to Sobhraj. The Real Serpent, Investigating a Serial Killer, is on Channel 4 at 9 p.m. and continues at the same time tomorrow. A new eight-part US drama inspired by true events starts tonight and follows the story of entrepreneur Elizabeth Holmes's attempt to revolutionise the healthcare industry with a biotech device that would lead a blood testing revolution. But Holmes was a fraudster, and her story ended in a prison sentence. The Dropout is on BBC One at 10:40 p.m. On to Wednesday the 20th of March. A pair of running shoes, a novelty drinks table, a woman's portrait and a barrel organ are some of the items for the experts to look at in the repair shop on BBC One at 8 p.m. A message from a woman in distress who reveals she has been assaulted by her boyfriend is just one of the calls received in tonight's episode of the documentary Ambulance on BBC One at 9 p.m. It's the moment of truth for the eight aspiring actors as they find out which three have made it to the final showcase. Bring the Drama is on BBC Two at 9 p.m. Former detective Jackie Moulton steps up her investigation, focusing on five murders committed in Thailand in the 1970s. Part two of The Real Serpent, Investigating a Serial Killer, is on Channel 4 at 9. Brothers Jake and Elwood Blues reform their legendary band to raise money when their old orphanage is threatened with closure. The musical comedy film The Blues Brothers is on ITV4 at 9 p.m. The Old Dogs are left to their own devices while Sasha is on a training course. New Tricks is on the Drama Channel at 10 p.m. Thursday the 21st of March. Meryl Streep stars as the boss from Hell in the glossy and entertaining fashion industry satire The Devil Wears Prada on Film 4 at 6:50 p.m. More entrepreneurs pitch their inventions in Dragon's Den on BBC One at 8 p.m. Lurcher Sky, Staffy Cross Leon and Cockapoo Puppy Annie are all hoping to win the hearts of new owners in tonight's episode of The Doghouse on Channel 4 at 8 p.m. A drama first shown in 2011 charts the early years of the comedy double act, focusing on the influence of Eric's mother. Eric and Ernie is on BBC 4 at 8:50 p.m. Former Metropolitan Police detectives assemble their evidence as they prepare to interrogate Charles Sobhraj for the last time. The final episode of The Real Serpent, Investigating a Serial Killer, is on Channel 4 at 9 p.m. Finally, we come to Friday the 22nd of March. As a steam train races through the countryside, Humphrey and Esther join the Shipton Abbott players for a murder mystery rehearsal. However, things turn from amateur to professional when the actor playing the victim is found dead. The first episode of a new series of Beyond Paradise is on BBC One at 8 p.m. Murder is no laughing matter when the priest visits a jester's convention. Father Brown is on the Drama Channel at 8 p.m. Joe Lycett embarks on a new set of adventures, starting in Trieste in northern Italy with the comedian and actor Alan Davis. Travel Man 48 Hours in Trieste is on Channel 4 at 8:30 p.m. Another chance to listen to Paul and Bob having a natter about this and that as they visit the Norfolk Broads. Mortimer and Whitehouse Gone Fishing is on BBC Two at 9:30 p.m. Although not audio described, my final choice of the week is a treat for any Roy Orbison fans. An evening of programmes on BBC Four starting at 9 p.m, dedicated to the American singer-songwriter, including a performance first shown in 1975. I hope you find something to enjoy from this week's selection.
DNF Soundings.
This is Rupert Evershed reading my monthly nature notes for the Hearts ad. Ivy, a feast for all seasons. Throughout the last few months of winter, the garden has been filled with the twittering music of redwings, feeding on the apparently abundant crop of ivy berries this year. The redwings, along with a multitude of other creatures, are the reason the ivy in our garden has been allowed almost free rein, so much so that it covers not just some of our big trees, but a whole shed roof too. Untidy it may be, but ivy is the plant that keeps on giving and provides for wildlife throughout the year, often when there's not much else on offer. The ivy ensures almost constant year-round activity in the garden and currently hosts a full complement of seasonal thrushes, redwings, blackbirds, song thrushes, mistle thrushes, and occasionally the odd field fare. Come spring, and already the tangled shelter of the ivy foliage will provide safe and dry nesting sites for blackbirds, song thrushes, robins, and blackcaps. Last year, I watched some blackbirds raise two broods in the ivy on our shed roof, and now the robin is busy carrying moss into another ivy den, no doubt to line this year's nest. Move on through summer to autumn, and the ivy, always crawling with insects, a ready-made larder for young beaks, will hum with a multitude of nectar-hungry wasps and bees. Holly blue and red admiral butterflies love our ivy in the late summer, and I like to think that the ivy does a service to us too, by providing so richly for the otherwise unemployed wasps. If it wasn't for the ivy, our lunchtimes outdoors would draw a bigger crowd of these vagabond insects. Now the ivy stands provide constant entertainment, as in addition to the redwings, wood pigeons have descended in their numbers to cash in on the free food. While the ivy doesn't register the weight of thrushes, it is a different matter for the portly pigeons. Undeterred, they launch themselves at the juiciest of berry clusters and deal with however little support from the ivy they receive. This leads to some hilarious sights and a lot of crashing and flapping of pigeon wings. Frequently, wood pigeons can be seen hanging upside down from the ivy, clinging on like parrots with their claws, wings spread downwards like a hung game bird, and yet ever straining for the very best berry in sight. They frequently fall off but seem remarkably adept at recovering uprightness, whether through a brief flight or crash landing on a new perch. Their sheer determination is evidenced in the profusion of white feathers all over our lawn, the price of a good ivy berry meal. I admire the wood pigeon's willingness to ditch dignity for a good meal. This tenacity and unexpected agility must account at least in part for their success in bucking the downwards trend of other species populations. That said, their boisterous activities do attract the occasional sally from the local sparrowhawk, and just this last week it may have accounted for a particularly low pass by a couple of peregrine falcons. I'm still getting used to the idea that peregrines fly over my garden. Once on the brink of extinction in Britain, they are now a regular part of the avian scene in St Albans, and can sometimes be seen perched on the abbey or circling high over the city centre. I perhaps have the wood pigeon feeding frenzy to thank for the below treetop flyby I witnessed. Maybe just a playful pass on the peregrine's part, but enough to panic the pigeons. Exploding outwards in all directions, a single tree often holds over 30 pigeons. The redwings and other thrushes remain, but fall utterly silent as the predator shockwave passes through. All of this drama is provided by the humble and much maligned ivy. I like to think that if the peregrines are doing well, then it is because of our ivy berries that fatten their pigeon meal. Or if the redwings make it back to Scandinavia across the harsh North Sea, then it is these ivy berries that fueled their flight and enabled a new generation of redwings to return next winter. Even after the berries are gone, the drama will go on, but to the gentler sounds of baby birds and humming insects.
Next up is an article from Hearts Life in which Bernard Bale interviews Sir Lewis Hamilton, who is now quite possibly the greatest Grand Prix driver of all time. It's read by Sue.
Hello, my name's Sue, and this article is from Hertfordshire Life. It's called Writing the Legend. From his working-class childhood in Stevenage, Lewis Hamilton dreamed big. After his seventh Formula One world title, he describes his extraordinary race to becoming the greatest driver of all time. The words are by Bernard Bale. It all began when I was a kid growing up in Stevenage and dreamed of becoming a racing driver. I dreamed about winning, but who would have ever thought that it would come to this? So says Lewis Hamilton as he continues to try to come to terms with becoming one of the world's best ever racing drivers, perhaps the best, after equaling Michael Schumacher's record of 7 Formula One World Championship titles at the Turkish Grand Prix last November. At the start of the race, he already held the record for the most pole positions, and earlier in the season overtook Schumacher's total 91 Formula One race wins. That's very humbling, he admits. There have been so many great names in the history of motor racing. I really can't believe I've become one of them. My dream really has come true, and I meant it when I said, as he crossed the finishing line in Istanbul, that I hope it inspires all young people to believe. Before the sporting triumphs, the fame and the fortune, the story begins with Anthony Hamilton giving his 6-year-old son a radio-controlled car. I was hooked straight away, Lewis recalls. I just loved the speed and everything about it. Next step was a go-kart, and my dad took me to Rye House Kart Raceway near Hoddesdon for junior karting. I went to John Henry Newman School and did my best in the classroom and on the football pitch, but my mind was mostly on the next weekend and karting. All the time, his dad was doing several jobs to take care of his family and keep his son literally on track. From karting, Lewis went through the ranks of junior to senior racing. He had to be special behind the wheel, but all the time his dad was behind him, guiding, encouraging, and just being there. My dad did everything. In fact, I can't even begin to list what my dad did to help me to get where I am today. No matter how many wins I get, no matter how successful I am, I can never pay that back. I just try to at least show my appreciation. I'm proud of all my family, and it's quite mind-blowing to think that I've stamped the Hamilton name into the history books, for now and the future generations. My hero was Ayrton Senna, and I was inspired by him. Perhaps there are kids out there now who will see me as an inspiration. I hope so. While Lewis has set up home in Monaco, like so many other F1 stars, his father still lives in Hertfordshire, although he travels the world to support his son. I like Stevenage, and didn't want to move far away, so I live just outside the town, Anthony says. I see Lewis a lot, of course, and go to as many races as possible. I still get the same nervousness and the same heart palpitations when the race gets started. I'm with him all the way through the race. He adds, I guess we are unusual in that we came from nothing and we didn't have any special contacts. We opened the doors ourselves and we had to learn as we went along. We had no inside information. We just did it with Lewis doing the most important thing. He worked hard, learned quickly, and was a great natural driver and competitor. Lewis has often paid tribute to his hometown and his upbringing there, although he did receive a social media backlash when he spoke of his dream to get out of the slums on BBC Sports Personality of the Year in 2018. He immediately corrected himself and apologised later on Instagram for choosing the wrong words. "I don't see as much of Stevenage as I used to, for obvious reasons," he says. "I do get back now and then, though, and I've certainly never forgotten my roots in Hertfordshire. It was very good for me, and you don't turn your back on people and places who have helped you get where you are." So what's next for the man who has won 6 of the last 7 world titles in F1? A change of team? Retirement? Indianapolis? "There's a lot to talk about, of course," says Lewis, who celebrated his 36th birthday on the 6th of January. "When you get to the end of the season, and this year's late for obvious reasons, it's really good if you know what you're going to do next season and can take a couple of weeks off, go on holiday, and feel good for when you start preparing again. It's not just about getting back behind the wheel. There are many other things to do, from media, testing, sponsor events, administration, and all that stuff. I can't say too much, but I will say that working with Mercedes has been fantastic. The car is just great, which is why it has been way out there in the rankings. And the team, as I've said, is second to none. I feel good, and I'm still hungry to win. I think the day I lose that, I'll have to think about the future. But right now, I'm looking forward to the 2021 season. Of course, Lewis hasn't always been popular with the media. "There's not much you can do about that," he says. "One minute you're getting all the nice headlines, and the next minute people want to talk about your money, your views on racism, your private life, and usually with the hope that you're going to say something or reveal something that will give a different sort of headline. If I'm asked something, I try to answer honestly. What other people do with that is not something I can do much about." Recently, he has shown his support for the Black Lives Matter movement and spoken out about racism in this sport. "The black issue has meant a lot to me, and I do support anything that will make for peace and acceptance between people of all races," he says. If there is a key to his success, other than his ability, it is perhaps that he is a positive thinker. "You have to be, especially when you're racing," he says. "If you don't think you're going to win, then you probably won't. That's life. I was brought up to focus on winning when racing and to be positive in everything else. Positive thoughts make you happy, and they can make other people happy. I approach everyone and everything with positive thoughts." One thing really positive for Lewis is the knighthood he received in the Queen's New Year's honours. "Being called Sir Lewis Hamilton is so amazing that I can't help but smile," he says. "Like most other things that have happened to me, I can't help saying the same thing. Who would have thought it? Quite a few people, actually. Arise, Sir Lewis of Stevenage."
In 1978, after coaching many world-ranked athletes in a range of events, Tom McNabb went freelance and began work as technical director of the film Chariots of Fire, which won 4 Oscars. He worked closely with the screenwriter Colin Welland, who later said, "The success of Chariots of Fire would have been impossible without the contribution of Tom McNabb." This is the first in a 4-part account, read by Tom himself, of his experience working on the film.
From memory, it was in late 1978 or early 1979 that I first read in the Sunday Times that Colin Welland was scripting a movie on Harold Abrams and Eric Liddell, gold medalists in the 1924 Paris Olympic Games. At that point, it bore a less than inspiring title and was called The Runners. Don't ask me how, but I somehow secured Colin's address, wrote to him offering my help, and within a week, he was sitting opposite me in my living room in St. Albans. It immediately became clear to me that Colin Welland was a sports nutter. Okay, perhaps not quite as nutty as me, not a fanatic who had devoted his life to sport, but a fellow nutter nevertheless. Thus, we immediately got along together like a house on fire, and within a week I was appointed to the role of script consultant at the prodigious sum of £500. Colin was still in the early stages of his research on the film, which was the product of someone called David Putnam, the head of a film company called Enigma Productions. The central themes of the film would be the anti-Semitism endured by Abrams at Cambridge University and Liddell's refusal, on religious grounds, to compete in the Sunday final of the Olympic 100 metres. In the case of Abrams, I had the advantage of knowing him, as he had in effect been my previous employer when I was a national athletics coach. Abrams, who died a couple of years earlier, had been a member of a privileged blazerati, a group who believed that they had been given by birth the divine right to rule British athletics. He was not, therefore, an immediately likeable character, and it would not be easy for Colin to make him one. And to my knowledge, Abrams, being Jewish, had not hindered him in reaching the ruling class of British athletics. Eric Little, on the other hand, he had the advantage of being a Scot. He was a man of a totally different complexion. But I pointed out to Colin that he had not refused to compete for Britain in the 100 metres, simply had not been chosen by his countries for that event in the first place. No, months before, Little had known that the 100-metre final would be on a Sunday, and as a devout Christian, he did not wish to compete on the Lord's Day. He'd instead, therefore, chosen to go for the two longer sprints, the 200 metres and the 400 metres. But I was to learn early in my role as script consultant that in the area of biographic feature film, writers tend to be free in their attitude to literal truth. All that was going to matter was that the characters of the two men were accurately portrayed within a plausible plot. And so I kept to myself my concerns about historical accuracy for the moment and let Colin get on with his research. And get on with it he did, and he soon came up against his first problem: difficulties in securing the help of another medalist, Douglas Lowe, who had achieved gold in the Paris 800 metres. Colin never made clear to me what problems he was having with Lowe, but my reaction was immediate, and it was that we take him out of the plot, because I felt that Lowe, being another gold medalist, might well take attention away from our two principals, Abrams and Little. Colin should therefore create a lighter, aristocratic contrast to our two principals, and I therefore suggested the fictitious Lord Lindsay. I chose for him the 400-metre hurdles as his event, not because it echoed Lord Burghley's later achievement in Amsterdam in 1928, but because I felt that it might be possible for me to train an actor in an event with such modest technical demands. These were ones which could be made even more modest by taking the hurdle down by 6 inches. After all, no one in the audience could possibly notice. We were by now into mid-1979, and it was now time for me to meet Putnam and the film's director, Hugh Hudson. Hudson, an old Etonian, seemed to me to have arrived from some distant planet. David Putnam, on the other hand, he was quite different. Deriving from a more modest background, he made no similar display of effortless superiority, having navigated his way through the demanding world of commercial films. And I was soon to find Putnam to be a leader of quite a different calibre from those like Harold Abrams, whom I had encountered in athletics. We all came together in mid-1979 for the first time at a Piccadilly club, and it was at this point that Putnam asked if I might extend my role and act as a sort of a technical director. This would mean choosing the actors for the physical roles, training them, then making certain that the film's athletic sequences looked real. For although athletics would occupy less than a tenth of the running time, it lay at the very heart of the film. If therefore its portrayal failed to convince, then no one would have much interest in the other 2 hours. And so it was back to the script. I had been for weeks boring the pants off Colin with my yarns about the famous New Year Powder Hall professional sprint in Edinburgh, and he now suggested that we have Little run in it. No, I replied. The issue of his amateur status would have prevented that. But, I suggested, why not have us introduce Little in a Highland Games, deep in the heather and the hills? Colin immediately agreed and inserted a new scene. But more of that later. So now let's move on to October 1979 and to a sodden cinder athletic track in Putney and 31 shivering actors standing before me, awaiting my commands. Alas, there was a significant lack of muscle on display, for those were the days long before health clubs and rippling abdominals. It was therefore not perhaps a surprise that several of my prospective Olympians were sick during the warm-up. "Remember, Tom," said David Putnam, "we'll go by your choice, so just give us the ones that you think you can make into athletes. Easier said than done, unless I had suddenly acquired the powers of a gypsy Petulengro, because it was impossible to predict how an actor's muscles might respond to training in sprints and hurdles, with hamstrings ever ready to twang and sensitive Achilles tendons just begging to become inflamed. So this was surely going to be a shot in the dark. Nevertheless, after an hour and a half in the freezing cold, I had chosen two actors, Ben Cross and Ian Charlson, for the main roles, and another four for the supporting parts. David Putnam smiled. Those were exactly the two men that we wanted, Tom. I really don't know how you did it. Neither did I. Thus, in November 1979, with 6 months to go to the 1924 Olympic Games in Paris, I set about training six actors who had never in their lives taken part in athletics, not only to compete, but to convince an audience that they were athletes, and to coach two of them to win Olympic gold medals.
On next week's programme, you'll be able to hear the next part in Tom's fascinating story.
TNF Soundings. Features from across the UK.
Hello again, folks. It's Liz from East Kilbride. Rose Riley, you may not know the name, but you know she's been overlooked too long, the lost superstar of Scottish women's football. Born in 1955 near Kilmarnock, and at the age of seven, she began playing with local boys at the club called Stourton United. She adored football. She was given a doll for her Christmas and swapped it for a football. Played keepy uppy on the road coming back from the school. And then at the playground in her school, she would go into the boys' playground, play football. And when the head teacher found out about this, she got the belt. But she didn't care because she wanted to play football. Now, she was able to play for this boys' team, but the coach, who knew she was a great wee player, took her aside and said, well, you can play for us as long as you have a short back and sides haircut and you'll just need to call yourself Ross. So that's what she did. Her mother nearly killed the barber when he found out about the haircut, but Rose did not care. She was playing one Saturday morning for this wee boys team, and a scout from the great Glasgow Celtic was on the sidelines, watched the play going on the pitch. And the scout turned to the coach of the wee team and said, well, we'll want to sign that wee number seven, great wee player. And the coach said, that number seven's a wee lassie. Now, what was going to happen to this wee lassie? Well, in Scotland at that time, not very much. The SFA, the Scottish Football Association, were completely against girls' football, women's football, professional football for women. It was absolutely a non-starter. Some of the women kept trying to play. They were never given any facilities at all. Never allowed to share buildings, so they would get changed behind trees and in the backs of cars. It was awful. And Rose decided she really, really was a good enough footballer to make it as a professional. Her case was taken up by Jerry Hassan, who was a reporter in Scotland, and he pointed out to her that if she wanted to go abroad, she would find the world of women's football and professional football was well established. So at the age of 17, she and her pal Edna came home one day, packed their suitcases and told their parents that they were going to go to France in the first instance, and if that didn't work, they were going to go on to Italy. As Rose says in her wonderfully vivid account, I had only ever eaten spaghetti hoops, and now I was talking about going to Italy. They set off age 17. She played for 6 months in Reims in the French League, and then she moved to AC Milan for 4 years. Rose found herself among the elite of European women footballers, and she thrived. She won championship titles in both Italy and France, would play in the French league on a Saturday, and then flew over to play another game on the Sunday. This fame did not go to her head. She remained the very much the same gal, but on the other hand, she did really embrace Italy. "I started drinking espresso coffee," she wrote. "I was being wined and dined all over Italy. Previously, the only place I'd been to was the Chippy in Stourton." This life, this success, brought Rose to the notice of the Italian football authorities, because they could see she was definitely their best player. Now, they wanted their best player to be playing for the Italian national side. Rose, at that point, was still a British citizen. There was an international coming up. The authorities in Italy had a plan to get her through the naturalisation system a bit faster. "I still hadn't been naturalised as Italian," says Rose. "So the president said, 'How do you fancy marrying some old guy in a nursing home?' 'God,' I said, 'I'm from a God-fearing family. My mother would have killed me.' So she had to wait it out till the paperwork came through." And indeed it did. In 1983, she was voted the world's best female footballer. And in 1984, she was selected for the Italian women's national team, was voted the best player in the Italian team, which won the Mundialito in 1984. And here's the big cruncher here. That was the early version of the Women's World Cup. So really, Scotland does have a World Cup winner in the persona of Rose Riley. She continued a long and amazingly successful career abroad, and she was still playing well into her 30s. And in fact, by the age of 40, she had retired. She was living in Sicily and running a sports shop, but still playing football, and kept playing in the local police seven-a-side team. And that's where matters take a romantic twist, because while playing for the local police team in Sicily, she tore a calf muscle and was referred to a local doctor, originally from Argentina, who specialised in sports injuries. And his name was Peralta, and that was the man who became Rose Riley's husband. So she's now Rose Riley Peralta. Finally retiring, and finally with a happy family life, Rose returned to Stourton. Really not very much known, though known in the local area as that great footballer. She was our great footballer. And recognition has come very gradually to Rose Riley. She's a patron and a very active supporter of the Walking Football Association. She has an honorary degree from Caledonian University in Glasgow. And then, most recently, in her own wee town of Stourton in Ayrshire, the sports centre was renamed the Rose Riley Sports Centre as a tribute to our local World Cup winner, our town's footballing superstar. How does Rose react to the sports centre being named after her? Here's what she says. "I gave away all my medals and trophies during my playing career, but having my local sports centre named after me is my legacy. I'm so proud for my wee village, and I'm so proud of this honour. So I think the reason we should look at Rose Riley, and she thoroughly deserves her place now in the Scottish Football Hall of Fame, is that she stuck to her beliefs that sport was important and valuable for women. She stuck to her view that if she couldn't play it properly in Scotland, she would follow her dreams, and they took her to a life beyond her wildest imaginings in France and in Italy, hailed as an international superstar. But then coming back to Scotland and hopefully seeing the attitudes changed, where Scotland has a vibrant national team, where women's football, which has been knocked back generation after generation, is now surely well established in sport in general and well loved by many men and women. And that's why I chose to give you the life, the personality and the wonderful talent of Scotland's World Cup winner, our footballer, Rose Riley.
TNF Soundings.
Hello everyone, this is 10 Today, a 10-minute set of exercises to do at home to help keep yourself active. Before we get to today's presenter, a couple of housekeeping points to note. The 10 Today project is funded by the Big Lottery and Sport England, and when you're doing the exercises, it's important that you don't push yourself too far, and by taking part, you agree to 10 Today's terms and conditions. You can read these terms and conditions at tnflink.uk/10T, and the 10T is the digit 1, the digit 0, and the letter T. And please remember that you agree to take part at your own risk. Today's exercises are brought to you by Jean, and here she is.
Hello everyone. This is a short 10-minute physical activity routine which will get you moving and stretching. It's great for your health, including improving your balance and building up your strength. Just take it at your own pace. There are plenty of options. If an exercise feels too much, just take it easy and have a break. All the exercises can be done either standing up or sitting down, so just do whatever feels good for you today. We want you all to do this exercise safely. You are responsible for monitoring how you are feeling throughout the session. If you feel any discomfort or pain, for example, if you feel unwell or dizzy or experience palpitations, then please stop and seek medical advice. If remaining seated, at least to begin with, it would be ideal if you can use a hard chair so you can sit upright. This could be a dining chair, preferably without arms, which can get in the way of some exercises. Then with your feet flat on the floor. Okay, if you are standing up, just step your feet hip width apart, relax your shoulders and stand up nice and tall, and take a couple of deep breaths. If you're sitting down, place both feet firmly on the floor. Keep your back straight, relax your shoulders, and take a couple of deep breaths. In and out. In and out. So the first exercise is called Reach for the Stars. So raise both your arms up to the sky, or stars. When at the top, rise on your toes and then lower both your feet and arms, pushing right down with your palms. So keep going, raising your hands up, then up on your toes, then lower your hands and feet. And keep going, feeling that nice stretch through the upper body and shoulders. So just a couple more now. Next, strike of the cobra, a wee bit of martial arts. So with a strong stance, with your fists clenched in front of your chest, as if you were a boxer, punch your right hand straight out and return. Then with the same hand, punch it to the left side. so that your arm crosses your body and reaches towards the ceiling. So you're punching up and across. And return. Now with your left hand, punch straight out and return. Then punch to the right side, so that your arm crosses your body, reaching for that ceiling again. Try not to worry with the logistics on this one. Just energetic punching is good. Keep going now, with alternate hands at your own pace. So punching straight, then to the side, pointing up to the ceiling. This is great for strengthening those arms. We should all be feeling nice and warm now. Now we have the side stretch. Raise your right arm high straight up with your palm facing up, then lean over to your left side, feeling that stretch all along your right side. Now return back to the centre. Raise your left hand straight up and feel that stretch all the way down your left side. Now keep alternating, feeling that nice stretch down your sides. So, arm up and lean over and repeat. Great work. Well done. Next, we have swing back. If you're standing, keep your legs straight. If you're sitting, keep your feet flat on the floor. Bend your arms so that both hands are at chest height. Then straighten out your right arm and swing it back so you feel a nice rotation in your back. Looking towards your right hand, then return to the centre and straighten out your left arm and swing it back, looking towards your left hand. And repeat. So you're just moving side to side, swinging your arms back nice and gently, feeling your back rotate as you move side to side. Just a couple more now. This is a great one for trunk rotation. Next, if you're standing, you might want to be near something you can hold on to for balance. This one is a leg raise. If you're standing, lift your leg up to hip height, keeping your knee bent, and return. And if you're sitting, lift your leg slightly higher than hip height, and return. Now do the same with the other leg, lift up to hip height, and return. Now do the same with the other leg, lift up to hip height, and return. Now keep going on alternate legs, so just lifting those legs up. Next is Slowly Does It. These exercises are slightly different if you're sitting or standing. So, if you're standing, bend at your knees slightly to halfway and hold. And then bend your knees all the way down to your lowest point and hold. And then straighten up your legs again. So you're just moving halfway, holding, moving down to your lowest point, holding, and then coming back up. Keep your feet facing forward and try not to let your knees move in front of your toes. Keep going. If you are sitting, just straighten out your right leg right in front of you and hold briefly, feeling that nice stretch down your leg. Then return your foot to the floor and repeat on the other side. Whichever variation you're doing, you're working your legs. If you're standing, you're also working your bottom. Okay, so keep going. Always remembering to keep your back straight. So, for those standing, bend your knees halfway, hold, and then all the way down, and then up. If just sitting, raising alternate legs. Slow and controlled is more challenging and rewarding. Just a few more. Great work. Push up to the moon. So remember to keep a nice soft bend in your knees and a strong stance. Then bend your arms so both hands are at chest height. Then push both your hands up to the ceiling on your right, as if you're pushing up to the moon. Then sweep your hands back down and to the left, pushing both your hands up to the ceiling again on your left, and now keep going. So you're just making a nice big U with your hands, pushing up to the moon on either side. When you sweep your hands at the bottom of the U, you can bend over slightly to make that sweeping movement bigger. Keep going with that nice dynamic shape, pushing up to the moon on each side. So again, if you're standing, you might want to be near something for balance. This exercise is called kick across, and you're just kicking your leg across to the opposite side. So kick your right leg to the left side and return. And do the same on the other side. So now keep going, kicking that leg across from side to side. You should feel that working your legs, and slow and controlled is more challenging here. Keep going for a couple more. Good work. Next is full circle. Raise both arms straight up above your head, and then sweep them round together to the right, making one big circle all the way back up to the top. And keep going, swinging one big circle to the right, just a couple more in this direction. Good work. Now we're going to do exactly the same, but the opposite direction. So keep making those nice big circles. It's a great workout for your shoulders, this one. Just a few more now. One more. Great job. Now we really should all be feeling warm. If you're a little out of breath, that's a good thing. It means you've been working. If you're not a little out of breath, can you work a little harder next time? Anyway, nearly finished. We'll just finish off with a nice stretch and cool down. So we're going to start with a hamstring stretch. So step forward with your right foot, placing your foot out in front of you with your foot flat on the floor. Then bend your left leg and put your hands on your hips and just lean forward gently. Whether you're sitting or standing, you should feel a nice stretch down the back of your leg. Hold four, 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Well done. Then return to a standing up position and swap your legs. So this time, step forward with your left foot, placing your foot out in front of you with your foot flat on the floor. Then bend your right leg and just lean forward gently. Again, feeling that nice long stretch. Hold four, 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. And now the final stretch, hugging a tree. Just hold your arms out in front of you, just as if you were hugging a tree directly in front of you. And your arms form a nice circle in front of you. And then cup your hands, putting one hand in front of the other, and push your hands together, feeling that nice stretch across your shoulders and arms. Hold four, 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Now sit up or stand up and return to that nice relaxed posture we had at the beginning. So, brilliant. That was all the exercises. We hope you enjoyed them. Just to finish off, shake it out. Just shake out those arms and hands and then legs and feet. Great work, everyone. Doing 10 today just 3 times a week can have great health benefits. It's fun and you'll simply feel better. So please do keep going. And thank you for listening.
TNS Soundings.
Hello, this is Sue. And here are some notable events which happened this week in the past. On the 17th of March, 461 CE, St. Patrick, the Christian missionary, bishop, and apostle of Ireland, died at Saul, Ireland. Much of what is known about St. Patrick's life comes from the Confessio, a book he wrote during his last years. Likely to have been born in Scotland, to a wealthy family of Roman citizenship, Patrick was captured and enslaved at 16 by Irish marauders, after which he spent 6 years working as a herder in Ireland. Later, increasingly religious and having been reunited with his family in Britain, a series of dream visions led him back to Ireland in 433 CE, where he was ordained a bishop and built many churches, including one in Saul, where he eventually died. Made into the patron saint of Ireland, many legends have grown up around St. Patrick. He is said to have baptized hundreds of people in a single day, and in art, he's often portrayed trampling on snakes in accordance with the belief that he drove all the snakes out of Ireland.
On the 18th of March, 1834, George Lovelace, James Lovelace, James Hammett, James Brine, Thomas Stanfield and his son John Stanfield, collectively known as the Tolpuddle Martyrs, were convicted. These Dorset farm labourers had been charged with having taken an illegal oath. However, their real crime, in the eyes of the establishment, was to have formed a trade union to protest about their meagre pay of 6 shillings a week, the equivalent of around 30p or roughly £50 a week in today's money, and their third wage cut in as many years. Workers met either under the sycamore tree in the village or in the upper room of Thomas Stanfield's cottage. Members swore an oath of secrecy, since wealthy landowners were determined to stamp out any form of organised protests. They were convicted and sent to work as labourers in Australia for 7 years, a sentence few ever returned from, as the harsh boat voyage and rigours of slavery took their toll. However, following sentencing, the working class rose up in support, and a huge demonstration marched through London to deliver a petition with 800,000 signatures to Parliament demanding their release. Eventually pardoned in March 1836, the Tolpuddle Martyrs' determination to be free and the huge uprising protesting against their conviction has since served to inspire generations of people to fight against injustice and oppression.
Following an agreement in Copenhagen in 1910, on the 19th of March 1911, International Women's Day was celebrated for the first time. 100 delegates, representing 17 countries, had agreed with the concept of the day as a way to promote equal rights, including women's suffrage, and it was honoured for the first time in Austria, Denmark, Germany and Switzerland. The first year it was celebrated, more than 1 million women and men attended International Women's Day rallies, campaigning for women's rights to vote, work, be trained, to hold public office, and protesting to end sex discrimination. In 1914, it was decided that International Women's Day would be marked annually on the 8th of March, and it continues to be celebrated worldwide as a day of collective global activism for women's equality.
At the University of Paris on the 20th of March, 1345, medieval scholars recorded that the Black Death was created by a triple conjunction of Saturn, Jupiter, and Mars in the 40th degree of Aquarius. The Black Death, also known as the Plague, swept across Europe, the Middle East, and Asia during the 14th century, leaving an estimated 25 million people dead. Despite the scholars' claim, the Black Death was caused by the Yersinia pestis bacterium and was carried by fleas that usually travelled on rats but also lived on other mammals. As the disease travelled across Eurasia, typically countries believed they were superior and immune to infection when their neighbours came down with the plague, but they soon found they were mistaken as the Black Death spread devastation in its wake. And by the time the worst was over in 1352, one-third of the continent's population had perished.
On the 21st of March, 1963, Alcatraz Prison, also known as The Rock, or America's Devil Island, in San Francisco Bay, closed. At its peak period of use in the 1950s, Alcatraz housed over 200 inmates in a maximum security facility, which was renowned for both its harsh conditions and for being inescapable. Featuring the most advanced security of the time, some of the first metal detectors were used at Alcatraz, and inmates were forced to comply with strict rules, including a highly structured, monotonous daily routine, conducted in almost complete silence at all times. While several well-known criminals were housed there, including Al Capone, George Machine Gun Kelly, and Robert Stroud, the Birdmen of Alcatraz, most of the prisoners were inmates who refused to conform to the rules and regulations in other prisons, who were regarded as violent and dangerous, or who were considered escape risks. Over the 29 years that the prison operated, there were 36 escape attempts from Alcatraz, and officially no one ever succeeded, although five prisoners were still listed as missing and presumed drowned.
On 22nd March 1963, the Beatles' debut album, Please Please Me, was rush-released by their record label to capitalise on the enormous success of the title track, which had been the group's second single and their first number one. 10 of the album's 14 songs were recorded in just one day, a fact acknowledged by Beatles historian and biographer Mark Lewisohn when he wrote, "There can scarcely have been 585 more productive minutes in the history of recorded music." The last song recorded that day was a cover of Twist and Shout, which had to be taped last, as John Lennon had a bad cold, and it was feared that if recorded at the start of the session, the throat-shredding vocal would ruin his voice for the day. Please Please Me was well received in Britain, where it remained in the top 10 for over a year, a record for a debut album that stood for half a century.
On the 23rd of March, 1857, the first passenger safety elevator began operating at a department store in New York City. Powered by a steam engine in the basement of the five-story building, it travelled at only 40 feet per minute. Nowadays, some lifts can travel at 40 feet per second. It was less than successful, as it was shut down after 3 years because customers were so reluctant to use it. Despite this, lifts have now become part of our everyday lives, and in New York City alone, it's estimated that over 3 million elevator trips take place every single day.
We're nearing the end of this week's programme. It just remains for me to thank our contributors, Lucy, Ian, Anne and Hilary, for the news, David and Sue for reading the events in history, Sue again for her reading from Heart's Life, Tom McNabb for Chariots of Fire, and of course John for the radio listings, Helen for the Audio Describe TV listings, and Rupert for his nature notes. Steve will be here next week with News Extra. But that's all from me in March 2024. We close with Rich Man's Hill by Maz O'Connor. I do hope you enjoy it. Goodbye for now and keep well.
And have you ever been to Rich Man's Hill? I swear the pavements gleam and all the little girls wear their hair in little curls, and their cheeks are strawberries and cream. They looked at me with a vague anxiety, something they knew just shouldn't be. But I don't mind, I know I'm bound to find my own hilltop home. I've been all round this city, I've been all round my mind. Work just doesn't stick to me. I seek, but I do not find. Well, maybe, maybe some of us were made to be safe. shall be my grave. Oh, but have you ever been to Rich Man's Hill? There's houses made for kings. How could anybody find themselves unhappy, surrounded by so many shiny things? I know they think I'm crazy, I know they think I'm small, I know they think that I don't think at all. But I don't mind, I know I'm bound to find